Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, online at myfloridahistory.org. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on the program, the 1925 book, History of Jacksonville, Florida and Vicinity, 1513 to 1924, is being republished for its 100th anniversary. We'll discuss what's in the book and what's missing.
So here's this famous person. Is she in Davis's book? No.
We'll discuss the evolution of tourism in Key West.
Key West in the 1920s was far from being a Florida paradise, with dwindling population, jobs, and industry.
And we'll talk about public history and the memory of Negro Fort. All that ahead on Florida Frontiers. For 100 years, the T. Frederick Davis book, History of Jacksonville, Florida and Vicinity, 1513 to 1924, has been a valuable resource for researchers and historians. It was the first book published by the Florida Historical Society in 1925. To mark the book's 100th anniversary, FHS Press has produced a facsimile of the book in paperback. While T. Frederick Davis's book contains a lot of valuable information, it is also noteworthy for what was excluded from the text. Historian John T. Foster points to the book Along This Way, the autobiography of James Weldon Johnson, to illustrate some of the Jacksonville history that T. Frederick Davis leaves out of his book.
But I would claim that James Weldon Johnson was the most important person born in 19th century Jacksonville. He was born there in June of 1871. He does all kinds of things. He goes to college in Atlanta, comes back and becomes the first certified lawyer in Florida after Reconstruction. He changes the curriculum of Stanton Institute so that it becomes a full-fledged high school. You also have the whole thing of Cookman Institute and how important it was. And again, try find Cookman Institute in Davis's book. When he was there, there were city policemen who were Black. There were several members of the city council who were Black. One or two justices of the peace were Black. There was a paid fire department, and one station was manned by Blacks. When I was in my teens, the city government was recognized. And Joseph E. Lee, a Black and very able and astute man, was made judge of the municipal court. This is the kind of thing Johnson's talking about. Try to find this in T. Frederick Davis's book.
James Weldon Johnson, who wrote the lyrics for Lift Every Voice and Sing, also known as the Negro National Anthem, was part of a thriving African-American community in Jacksonville in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. John T. Foster also finds problems with T. Frederick Davis's descriptions of Civil War-era Jacksonville.
Davis talks about slavery. He talks about how the politeness and the respect between the mammies and their families. This is sort of a portrayal of slavery as you'd seen in the movie Gone with the Wind. You have Blacks that are treated with some degree of respect. But what's being omitted from all this is the treatment of field slaves. I have no question that there weren't some slaves who were in the households that were treated halfway decently. I didn't say fully decently, but they're a tiny minority of slaves. What about the 90% that are out there working in the cotton fields, planting the cotton, tending it, harvesting it. That's not what Davis is talking about, how they were treated. It's this small group of people that you see presented in Gone with the Wind.
During their research on Reconstruction-era Jacksonville, John T. Foster and his late wife, Sarah Whitmer Foster, acquired the 1860s newspaper articles of the Reverend John Sanford Swaim. One of Swaim's articles, published in May 1865, describes in graphic detail the arrival in Jacksonville of approximately 3,300 Civil War prisoners from Andersonville, Georgia. Prior to the arrival of the prisoners, Swaim was not an abolitionist, but afterwards became an active proponent of building schools and churches in Jacksonville's African American community.
Why did he change? I think it's because of what he saw from the Andersonville stuff. Because these men came, and some of them were in such poor condition that they could not return to the North. And by the time he wrote the article in mid-May, 30 of these men had already perished, and more were going to die. There was no way they could return to the North and go home. So what did they look like? These men had many of their clothes removed when they went to Andersonville. Some of them were just given rags. A lot of them were exposed to the weather continuously. They're also exposed to fire that was largely burning the exterior of pine trees, which meant these men were getting sticky soot all over their bodies. Add to this, there were no combs, there were no razors. So these men are half naked. They are covered with soot. They look like something bizarre. Add to this, there were people who had the symptoms of scurvy, because the basic meal there was a half a pint or a pint of poorly boiled corn and 2 inches of pork, bacon, that is. So they're not getting anything like a real diet. So some of these men are in incredibly poor condition, and Swaim's having to do the funerals.
John T. Foster finds it problematic that T. Frederick Davis does not mention the Andersonville prisoners in his book, History of Jacksonville, Florida and Vicinity, 1513 to 1924. Foster has written extensively about Harriet Beecher Stowe, including the book, Calling Yankees to Florida, Harriet Beecher Stowe's Forgotten Tourist Articles. As author of the 1852 novel Uncle Tom's Cabin, Harriet Beecher Stowe was one of the most famous women in the world and lived in the Jacksonville area for 17 winters.
So here she is, one of the most world-famous women. And guess what? She wrote 57 articles about coming to Florida or life in Florida. One of her goals, which she never says in public, is she's trying to create tourism in Florida. And by 1874, the New York Times reported 50,000 tourists or visitors in Florida in the last season. Now, that isn't there earlier. In fact, after the Civil War, there's hardly anything going on. And so here's this woman. She's joined by a few other famous people. Swaim's doing the same thing. They're all part of a group of people who believe that you can create a place of freedom. And where would you do this? Well, Florida was an attractive target. So here's this famous person. Is she in Davis's book? No.
In his book, At the Dawn of Tourism in Florida, Abolitionists, Print Media, and Images for Early Vacationers, John T. Foster credits Harriet Beecher Stowe with promoting tourism in Florida, along with other progressives like William Colin Bryant. Known as a poet and editor of the New York Post, Bryant also edited a set of richly illustrated tour books that included Florida. Foster points out that T. Frederick Davis overlooks Stowe, Bryant, and Reverend Swaim in his discussion of tourism in Jacksonville.
The most important feature of the book is that he carefully describes the building of hotels in the 1870s. These, in indicating the real existence of tourism, keep in mind that the 1870s, starting in 73, was about the third or fourth worst depression in the history of the United States. It was really dreadful. And there are occasionally times when the people that have finished talking about the Great Depression eventually get around to talking about the one in the 1870s. But Davis talks about the building of four hotels in Jacksonville and the economy thriving. Now, that wasn't the entire economy. The lumber mills and wood processing was big in Jacksonville, but that did not thrive in the 1870s. But if you wanted to know the hotels, they were the Grand National, which was close to the waterfront. It's in many lithographs showing the city of Jacksonville. The Duval, the Windsor, and the Carlton. And so he talks about them building the hotels, but and the rapid growth in tourism, but never explains why it grew.
The T. Frederick Davis book, History of Jacksonville, Florida and Vicinity, 1513 to 1924, remains a valuable resource for researchers, not only for the content that is there, but also for the author's distinctly Southern viewpoint and the omission of African Americans and women that played important roles in Jacksonville history. That missing material also tells us something about Jacksonville history. The Florida Historical Society Press has published a 100th anniversary edition of T. Frederick Davis's History of Jacksonville, Florida and Vicinity, 1513 to 1924, available in paperback. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Visit us online at myfloridahistory.org to find out about all of the great speakers at the Florida Historical Society Public History Forum being held May 15th through 17th in Orlando. The conference also features tours of historic sites, museums, and archives, and much more. That's myfloridahistory.org. Joining us now is Connie Lester, Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. Connie, Key West has been a topic of interest for Florida researchers and readers in all periods of the island's history. Special attention has been focused on the New Deal revitalization of the island, with historian William Barnett arguing that Key West was an escape from America. Philip Levy, an historian and anthropologist from the University of South Florida, contests this view and does so by examining the writings of a popular author of the 1920s.
In his 2009 Florida Historical Quarterly article titled "The Most Exotic of Our Cities," Levy explores the writings of George Allen England, an American author best known for his utopian science fiction, to argue that England's 1920s travel books cast Key West in the framework of modernity with its incorporation of imperialism and racial hierarchies. Levy claims that England challenges Key West exceptionalism to claim the island as an essentially American and modern location that demonstrates the ability of whites to live in a tropical environment through the implementation of advanced technology. Born in Nebraska in 1877, England was a Harvard graduate and a politically active socialist who began wintering in Key West in 1918. Embedding himself in the culture of the island, he came to be called the Key West Ambassador as the result of his public praise for the benefits of living on the island. Although best known for his book Darkness and Dawn, which was published in 1914, Levy focuses on his Caribbean islands travel books. England's views, like many intellectuals of the time, included a decided opinion on racial ordering and a belief that Anglo-Saxon descendants could not live in tropical climates. As he studied the islands of the Caribbean, he found Key West to be an exception, and Levy argues paved the way for the island to become a tourist destination. England's version of exceptionalism was the modern technology that linked Key West to the continent and made it American rather than Caribbean.
Connie, Key West in the early decades of the 20th century was not what most people called paradise. There were stories of pirates and wreckers from past days, but also tales of yellow fever. Charles Richard Dodge of Scribner's called it a dusty old town where there was very little of interest to hold the tourist. Dodge listed the cigar, sponge, and turtle meat industries, but concluded that the city served as a stopover on the way to what really made Florida a travel-worthy destination.
That about sums it up. Other writers also found Key West less than inspiring. Nevin Winter, who wrote Florida, Land of Enchantment in 1918, asserted that Key West could not be called a beautiful city and proceeded to list all the things that made it too much like the northern cities tourists wanted to leave behind. Elmer Davis, writing in the mid-1920s, lamented the now easy link between Key West and South Florida. As Levy explains, what was special about Key West for Davis was that it avoided becoming American and consequently maintained its cultural independence in an age of increasing consumer homogeneity. In his writings, Davis was not simply praising Key West, but condemning American consumer culture. England published his work during a fraught time when Americans were in the midst of a period of Caribbean and Latin American adventurism. And the question of the ability to live in tropical climates was part of the public discussion. Levy asserts that, quote, for England, Key West's mix of people and environment made the city a test case for just what American civilization could do and become in unfamiliar climes, end quote. The result was what he repeatedly called perfection. Key West in the 1920s was far from being a Florida paradise with dwindling population, jobs, and industry. Still a frontier community, the port town was a hub for legal and illegal trade. But England saw other possibilities. In his mind, Key West was a garden spot, an earthly paradise, and the finest place in the world. Not just hyperbole, Levy argues, that England believed Key West provided just the right mix of factors to produce a sort of perfect place, a tropical paradise that offered a blend of environmental and technological achievements. And he took Americans through a carefully guided tour of the city to highlight its natural, technological, and human wonders. England presents Key West as a West Indian city akin to Cuba or Haiti, and presented Flagler's Overseas Railroad and new Overseas Highway as the 8th and 9th wonders of the world. He claimed that visitors should have no fear of the Key West climate and disingenuously assured readers that hurricanes were not a source of concern, since the city was, quote, built upon a rock and would not be moved, end quote. He presented the Latin and Black populations of Key West as quaint, unlike his writings about other non-white populations elsewhere in the Caribbean, implying that they existed quietly under white authority. As Levy explains, quote, as an advocate of Anglo-Saxon imperialism, England saw great potential in the tropical places he visited, but he was also aware of the social and evolutionary dangers many of his countrymen and women saw in steaming mangroves and long white coastlines. The Key West that England presented to the American reading public was a place carefully fashioned to show the possibilities for the great things his Nordics could achieve in the right settings. By contrasting Key West with similar tropical places and focusing on interrelated issues of race, industry, and technology, England positioned Key West as a model, a perfect place, partly unique in its meeting of circumstances and partly a vision of what an Anglo-Saxon Caribbean world might achieve. Key West continued to decline despite England's enthusiasm for its greatness and fell into receivership, a ward of the Roosevelt administration. Its emergence from receivership to become a tourist destination under the guidance of Julius Stone was explained by Levy as having much earlier foundations. Quote, although Stone had the authority and the money to enact its transformation, and although he became one of the town's most ardent boosters, he did not invent the vision he promoted. That genesis rested with George Allen England and his interests in the evolutionary potential of island environments, end quote.
And of course, Key West continued to evolve into the popular tourist destination it is today. Thanks, Connie.
You're welcome.
Connie Lester is Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. This is Florida Frontiers. Sebastian Garcia and John Lancaster will be giving a presentation at the upcoming Florida Historical Society Public History Forum called Performing Public History, Representing the Memory of Negro Fort Through Podcasting. Sebastian Garcia tells us more.
John Lancaster is a master's history student at the University of Central Florida, specializing in mid to late 20th century European history through the lens of historical memory. I spoke with John about his specific research regarding Negro Fort memory in the 19th century and his overall perspective on this collaborative research project, which began in Dr. Barbara Gannon's graduate history colloquium on American slavery.
We read a selection of important books on the topic, one of which was Matthew Clavin's 2019 book, The Battle of Negro Fort. And this book introduced me to the entire concept of the fort, which before that I didn't even know existed. It was a fort that existed near Tallahassee along the Apalachicola River in the panhandle of Florida. The fort was initially constructed by the British during the War of 1812. And following the war, when the British evacuated the fort, they left the fortifications and all of their weaponry to a group of growing Native American and Black Maroons. And between 1815 and 1816, these Maroons lived at the fort, where they lived as a self-sufficient community. Because they were left with a significant amount of weapons and ammunition, they also presented pretty significant anxieties to the southern states in the early 19th century, as they represented a significant form of resistance to slavery and a growing slaveocracy that characterized 19th century southern ideologies.
From my specific research, Negro Fort memory has fluctuated significantly since the 20th century. John, however, discovered a different pattern in the 19th century.
What I found in my own research was that the memory of Negro Fort in the 19th century was comparatively robust. And I found a lot of different writers and commentators throughout the 19th century engaged with the memory of the fort for their own unique reasons. So for example, abolitionists before the Civil War engaged with a particular memory of the fort to bolster their own ideologies. Postbellum writers engaged with the memory to help justify Jim Crow era ideologies, and even African American writers in the postbellum era utilized the memory of Negro Fort as a means of resistance at a time of continued Black community oppression. For example, one source that I found particularly fascinating was written by a Black educator in Georgia whose name was Edward Austin Johnson. He worked in a number of segregated schools in Georgia throughout the late 19th century, and he wrote a book in the early 1890s, The History of the Negro Race between 1619 and 1890. And his goal in writing this textbook, which was written for children, was to help give this new generation of Black Americans an insight into their recent history, considering that most of these people had parents or grandparents who had been enslaved. And Johnson recollects the story of Negro Fort in this example, and paints quite a graphic and visceral picture of what happened during the destruction of the fort in order to reflect some of the issues contemporaneous to his own time. Again, a time of continued Black oppression and violence committed against Black communities.
Part of our panel aimed to demonstrate how the podcast medium represents a unique space for traditional academic research, especially for Negro Fort memory. John shared his perspective as someone who, before this research project, had no experience producing academic historical podcasts.
I have written conference papers before, and I have written academic papers before. And so I was delighted and actually surprised to find out that there were a lot of overlaps between writing academic traditional conference papers and adapting them to the podcast medium. Although it was a new experience for me, it wasn't completely impossible to understand. That being said, I think some of the important takeaways I've learned from this experience is how certain elements of the podcast medium can be used to engage audiences even more with the projects that I work on. So for example, certain elements of the podcast medium, like music and sound effects, provoke emotion in audiences. And emotion is something that is crucial to memory. And when writing a traditional conference paper or an academic paper in a class, memory is often intellectualized in a way where, though emotion certainly is a crucial aspect of it for many people and how they engage with memory, doesn't necessarily come across that way in an academic paper. Now, that's not to say that in podcasting, especially an academic historical podcast, we don't engage intellectually with concepts like memory. However, for larger audiences, engaging with memory through elements like music and voiceovers create a much more visceral experience for audiences, which is one element that I really appreciated with the podcast medium. Additionally, this topic on Negro Fort especially proved useful to adapting to this medium because Negro Fort is obscured in American history and in historical memory generally. And podcasting, on the other hand, has only been growing in popularity and is not obscured at all. And so one of our biggest draws to adapting this story for the podcast medium was to help illuminate the whole story of Negro Fort and how people have engaged with it through time and kind of challenge some of the narratives that suggest that Negro Fort was always this obscured. And one of the best ways that we found to do it was to utilize all the elements of the podcast medium in order to bring it to the largest audience possible and illustrate its historical significance.
Given John's interest in historical memory, researching Negro Fort Remembers provided a space to refine his understanding and skills regarding memory.
Certainly, the emphasis on memory remains the most significant takeaway that I've had from this entire project. As with anything that you learn, practice makes perfect, to use the analogy. And being able to engage with primary source materials and considering how they interact with the historical moments that they were produced in really allowed me a crucial space to better understand memory.
For Florida Frontiers, I'm Sebastian Garcia, a graduate history student, FHS media production assistant, and history podcaster at the University of Central Florida, Department of History.
You've been listening to Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. Please join us right here again next week. Until then, visit us anytime online at myfloridahistory.org, where you can still register for the Florida Historical Society Public History Forum taking place May 15th through 17th in Orlando. Production assistance for Florida Frontiers comes from Connie Lester and Sebastian Garcia. The program is edited by Giselle Concepcion. Have a great week. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State Division of Historical Resources and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org.